This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Richard, Tom and myself have been up to on a Tuesday morning. And that's been quite a workplace-focused Tuesday. We've been looking at a new study suggesting that a lot of people around the world consider themselves to be vacation deprived. We've been looking at the case here in the UAE with the managing partner of Comp and Ben Middle East. Greece has also issued a new law that employers can mandate a 6-day working week in a number of sectors if they want to. We've been speaking about what works, 6 days, 4 days, 5 days, with Oliver Baxter, who's the founder and owner of Workplace Maven. And with 140 metro stations on the plan for 2040 here in Dubai, we've been looking at what that might mean for rents and for property values, both residential and commercial. Andrew Elliott is the director of the commercial agency at the real estate company Chestertons.
Oil on the rise at the moment, hitting highs in recent trading sessions, climbing another 2% overnight, nudging ever closer towards that $90 a barrel for Brent. That's certainly one of the predictions coming from a number of analysts out there. We asked Dan Richards, the senior economist at Emirates NBD, whether this was A, justified, and B, sustainable.
We remain a bit sceptical that there's sufficient demand to really push it towards $90 a barrel on a sustainable level. So for Brent futures, they rose 0.2% yesterday to close at $86.6 a barrel, and has added a further 0.3% this morning, while WTI has seen even stronger gains of 2.3% yesterday, closing at $83.4 a barrel. However, for WTI, the threat of Hurricane Beryl was really the main factor behind that spike, while Brent prices were supported by renewed concerns around geopolitical tensions in the wider Middle East. On a fundamental level, though, the weak official PMI surveys out of China over the weekend were just the latest indicators to open up demand strength to questions.
Dan Richards, senior economist, Emirates NBD. Right, big old focus for us today throughout the course of this morning on all things work and all things leave. Everybody's working. Brandy, who are you talking to shortly?
I'm speaking to Oliver Baxter, working towards the weekend. But in Greece, it could be a one-day weekend. Now, I say that knowing that there are obviously many, many people here in the UAE who actually do work a six-day week. And in fact, I think I'm looking at one who did when he first moved to the UAE. Did you not both?
Yes, I did. My first job here was 1998 for a publishing company called Motivate. And the weekend then was basically Friday, but you finished a bit early on the Thursday, like 2-3 o'clock on a Thursday. Now that changed. I arrived late 98. Within a year, that had changed to a full Friday, Saturday weekend. But that was the norm when I got here.
Yeah, no, I was chatting randomly to someone yesterday afternoon who was on a 6-day week. So it might not be surprising to many. What is interesting, though, is in Greece, it is a sea change coming from the government because there aren't enough skilled workers. And this is maybe or maybe not a solution. We've had in some messages this morning questioning the how much work is actually done in Greece. I can tell you that the Greeks work an average of 41 hours per week. That is more than any other EU country. And the pay for that is low by European standards. And yes, to those who have pointed out that they'll get paid for the sixth day, they will, but at 40% of your daily wage. I just look at this and I think, no, that's not going to make anybody happy, is it?
So you get less if you work an extra day. Traditionally, we think overtime, time and a half or something. If you're on 10 euros an hour normally, if you work overtime, you'd get 13 or 15. But actually, you get time less than half.
Because it's not overtime. There's complications around what was overtime, what isn't. The hospitality sector's not in this because they've already had their 5-day work week abolished last year. So there's different sectors that this applies to. But not being an expert on Greek law, I'm not sure how the overtime works. But basically, it's not overtime for this. This is now your work week.
This is just real life.
Yeah. So Our question this morning is, does this buck the trend that we're seeing elsewhere? We're seeing Germany, Belgium, their experiments in the UK, New Zealand and other countries to go to a four-day work week. And we know here down the road in Sharjah, we had that massive change for schools and for government departments and things here going to basically, you know, 4.5 days, if you like, that sort of half-day Friday. But what does it actually do for the workforce and for productivity? That's what we're going to be discussing with Oliver.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, what have we been doing this morning? You've been talking to the team from Global SWF.
Doing deals, Thomas, yes, sovereign wealth funds and Middle East wealth funds dominating the list. This is Global SWF. It's a consultancy that ranks sovereign wealth fund deals, and they look at the oil five, they call them, which are the five sovereign wealth funds most active from the Middle East. You've got three of them in Abu Dhabi, Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, the OG, plus new upstarts like Mubadala. Then you've got PIF in Saudi Arabia and the Qataris as well. And they are dominating the scene at the moment. $38 billion worth of deals out of the 52 done this year by sovereign wealth funds were by the oil five in this part of the world. Been speaking to the boss of Global SWF, he's Diego Lopez. We asked him, any surprise that it's the Middle East companies that dominate?
Not really. I mean, this is a trend that we have been seeing for the past 2 years. I think the oil prices obviously help in getting the Middle East funds to be very active and much more so than the global counterparts. So in general, funds are acting very cautiously, but Middle Eastern funds, because of the oil windfall that they are receiving, they need to put that capital into play and to work.
So I asked him, is it simply a case of high oil prices, nudging $90 a barrel at the moment for Brent crude? Is it simply that their oil companies just print loads and loads of money, gives it to the wealth funds, and then they just go shopping?
Not necessarily. I mean, obviously, the oil windfall is there and they are receiving the capital. However, every fund has been on a different journey, right? So if we talk about the Abu Dhabi funds, ADIA, for instance, as you know, has been around for 50 years. They're a very sophisticated, very mature investor. ADQ is more recent and, you know, it has been more active recently, but in very different kind of deals. And the same happens with the neighbors, PIF in Saudi or QIA in Qatar. So they're all in very different journeys. And it's not as simple as, you know, them receiving the money and investing in anything they see. There is a process that goes behind, obviously.
But then we looked at some of the deals, and Brandy, both you and I noticed this. Some of them, it's not a wealth fund going out and buying, I don't know, a hotel in Manhattan. It's money moving around within the country. One of them, for example, was Lunate, Abu Dhabi Wealth Fund, spending $5 billion on assets, oil pipelines from ADNOC. It's like, is that really a sovereign wealth fund deal? Does it really count? This is what Diego had to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a trend that we're seeing. I think the recycling and the sort of investing within the region. I mean, that deal that you're mentioning, it was interesting because it was sold to BlackRock and KKR a few years ago. And now we're seeing it the other way around with a local company buying that stake. So I think, you know, one has to be careful, as you said, what to classify as a deal, as an investment. And, you know, we have a lot of government transfers as well. I mean, there in Dubai, we saw a huge transfer of Maidan and Nakheel being transferred from ICD to Dubai Holding. So we put an asterisk into it and we classify it differently just because the nature of it is very different.
Diego Lopez, founder and managing director of the consultancy Global SWF.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Where we're talking vacations on the Business Breakfast or the lack thereof.
I'm on vacation every single day because I love my occupation. I'm on vacation.
Yeah, we love a vacation, but are you getting enough? New survey from Expedia says 2/3 of people around the globe feel they are, quote, vacation deprived, not getting enough annual leave. In Europe, where they get the most vacation days, even more people are disgruntled. 90% of Germans fear that they are not getting enough. Joining us in the studio now to discuss this is the compensation and benefits expert, Martin McGuigan. He's the managing partner of Comp and Ben Middle East. Morning, Martin.
Good morning.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of this. First of all, though, you want to address the elephant in the room, which is holiday company Expedia says we need more holidays.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a sort of leading question that they're asking. Do we need enough holidays when they sell vacations. So we've got to take it all with a pinch of salt, right?
We do. And I'm not claiming this is a piece of peer-reviewed research. 11,500 people they've spoken to, Expedia, and not in the UAE, but globally. And the conclusion is most people think they want more vacation. But I thought we'd look at it because it is an interesting issue, particularly in the summertime. How much annual leave do you get? Is it too much? Some HR officers may say it is. Is it not enough? What are your thoughts?
So I think it sort of depends where you are in your career for a start, because what you tend to find, the data will tell you that as people progress, they take less and less of their allowance. Now, in the UAE, when I came 15, 16 years ago, this was actually a big problem for many government entities because people simply didn't use it. But they were building up huge banks of time, which unfortunately the policies at the time meant had to be paid out. So it was creating quite a lot of a liability for the company that when people left, they got paid these big extra checks for unused holiday time. That's no longer the case for a number of reasons. First of all, from a corporate wellness point of view, HR and I realized people need time off, right? So you need to recharge, you need to come back into work and have had a rest and a break so you can get back at your full sort of impact level. But also from a risk point of view, depending on your industry, you know, one of the very famous stories from years ago was Nick Leeson never took a day off because he spent all of his time covering his tracks. Right?
Just for our younger listeners, remind us who Nick Leeson is.
He was the man that broke Barings Bank and racked up $1 billion dollars worth of trading losses in a short period of time. And his whole career, he was famed in the Singaporean office for never taking a day off. But what he was doing was creating false accounts to cover his tracks. So now from a risk and compliance point of view, many big organizations, especially in financial services, will make employees take 2 weeks of solid holiday.
Okay, let's look at some of the issues here. How do we stack up in the UAE? You've crunched the numbers on the days of annual leave that we get. We're talking full-time employees here. Yeah. We'll get to the gig economy in a second because I know it's important. But full-time employees, the amount of annual leave we get in our contract, and you say it's important to look at the number of government holidays as well. Where do we rank?
Yeah, we're about mid-table. I mean, I think the UAE does pretty well, depending, as we know, when the weekends fall for public holidays here, it can be a little bit, it can feel a little bit challenging sometimes because we have public holidays falling on Saturdays and Sundays now. Whereas the actual vacation days you get, it's 30 days, but that usually boils down to about 24, 25 weekdays. And that's pretty much mid-table. Most of the world, you have sort of between 20 and 30, with the exception of the United States, which tends to, you know, make it really difficult for people to take time off and limit to about 10 or 12.
Yeah, and that was interesting from this survey, that even though the French and the Germans get the most time off around the world in this survey, almost 30 days annual leave a year, plus public holidays, they're the ones who are most dissatisfied with this so-called vacation deprivation.
Yeah, I think that comes down to culture as well, right? It's when you do, for example, employee engagement surveys, you know, if you get an engagement score in Japan of anything less than 70, you should be pretty depressed because your company's doing badly. People wouldn't be employed or engaged. But if you translated that score to somewhere like the UK, anything over 45 is brilliant. So culturally, the US don't take time off. They work, you know, from a work ethics point of view, maybe a little harder than their European counterparts. And there is an attitude in some of the Northern European countries that they're entitled to, you know, almost be looked after and babied. So I would say put it in the context of that. Some of the other interesting countries there, Japan and Hong Kong, the survey said that they are really happy, but the way they take their time is very different. Hong Kong has 19 public holidays. So you can see that they take a couple of days, almost long weekends, almost every month. So you're getting these little mini breaks, whereas this holiday is talking about the sort of 1-2 weeks by the beach and the poolside, which is slightly different.
You asked the question, does it really matter anymore as we move towards A, the gig economy, and B, towards digital nomads and work from anywhere?
Yeah, I think that's probably the more pertinent question. There's a lot of thinking at the minute that says that when we move towards sort of skill-based jobs, when people will come in with a specific set of talents that will be needed for a short period of time, we're going to have to look at the way we contract people anyway. And that sort of whole premise is you work where and when you want. What suits you is a driving factor. So if you've got somebody who's under the age of 30 and says, well, I only want to work 3 months at a time, they'll probably work night and day for 3 months and then take 2 months off. So as we progress and work changes, and it won't change for everybody, but you know, there'll be a lot of jobs, especially in technology, a lot of jobs where you can actually just do what you want. This idea of having a number of days sort of disappears. In addition to that, when you look at the way that, you know, it doesn't work for you guys, you've got to be in the studio, you've got to actually be here in front of a microphone. But most people now, if they're in office jobs, can work from home. So, you know, there's a blurring of the lines between that old culture of I must be at my desk to the new culture of I must do my work regardless of where and when I do it, which is what employers want.
Yeah, I mean, most surveys would suggest that about a third of jobs can be done remotely. Two-thirds, you need to be there. You're a doctor, you're a nurse, you're working in hospitality, air traffic control. But about a third in developed economies can be done from anywhere. Is that about right from what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's about right. And I think it's growing because there will be more and more jobs that will be, you know, taken over by the bots, right? So AI is going to make a lot of people have to rethink what they're doing career-wise. But those people that are in a fortunate position, they can take time off. Companies are not necessarily worried about things like, you know, how many hours you're putting in. They're actually more worried about things like risk of tax mismanagement. So if I choose from the UK to sit here for, you know, most of my time, but then go back to the UK for 92 days instead of 88, then the company's got my annual liability for tax in the UK. So there are lots of things companies need to think about now about where you're working and when you're working.
What about HR officers here in the UAE and Saudi Arabia? You do a lot of work there. 30 seconds. Do they feel that we're getting too much leave? The guys who are paying our salaries, they have a different perspective.
No, I think what all the studies will say, and they will back this up, is what they want is engaged and happy people because they work harder and deliver more. So they would actually encourage people to take and utilize their full allowances.
Are you taking a summer holiday? You've just set up a new business.
I have set up a new business and I am taking a summer holiday, but I'm going to be one of those digital nomads working from the UK for about 68 weeks. Yeah.
Nice stuff. Martin, good to see you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us this morning. Martin McGuigan is the managing partner, Comp & Ben Middle East.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We've got quite the work focus this morning. Rich having a chat earlier about which countries have the people who get the least holiday or take the least holiday. They're not necessarily the same things. And at the same time, new story coming out of Greece, that the Greek authorities have introduced a new law that will allow employers in a number of sectors, from retail to services, to impose a six-day working week on staff if they need to. Very pleased to be joined by Oliver Baxter, founder and owner of Workplace Maven. Oliver, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously we need to start by recognising that there's an awful lot of people here in the UAE who will be on a six-day week thinking, how is that a new thing? But it is a major move for the Greek government. It's after 15 years of recession, a way of dealing with a lack of skilled staff in the country. Is imposing something, though, and we could just start with that word, ever a good idea?
No, not really. But let's face it, Greece probably haven't gone far enough. Why not do 7 days? Let's have everybody work all hours of the day and have no time for their family or to get a good nutritious meal or to exercise. Have they pushed it far enough, Brandy? That is my question.
Oliver, for those who are not watching on television, has a look on his face which shows that his tongue is very firmly in his cheek. Talk to me about how this fits in with what we're seeing elsewhere, because there are a huge amount of four-day week trials going on at the moment, aren't they? We've got Germany, Belgium, here in some areas, the UK, New Zealand.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, if you look at Greece, they have the longest, you know, working week in Europe, as you quite rightly pointed out earlier on. If working longer hours increased performance and productivity, then surely Greece would have the strongest economy in the region. Whereas if you look at like Spain, Portugal, the UK, Iceland, they were one of the first horses out of the gate in this fight for a four-day work week. We actually see that the performance and the productivity and the profitability of organizations actually increases significantly, about 20% by reducing the working week. You get that increase of 20% as well.
Why is that?
We need more time. You know, if I was to ask you to run a marathon on a Monday morning and then again on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, you wouldn't have the same qualifying time, you know, consecutive days because we need time to rest and recover. Now, if you look at the brain consumes about 20% of the body's energy in a given day. So, of course, there's blue collar and there's, you know, white collar professions as well. That's a mix of both physical labor and cognitive processing. So we need to relax our brain as well as our musculoskeletal system in order to wake up refreshed and energized and willing to do a good day's work.
Is this all coming to the fore now, Oliver? Why at this point in our history are we tinkering with the work week?
Well, it's happened before. Henry Ford was one of the early pioneers of going to a five-day work week when previously it was globally 6 or even 7 days. It was previously 7 days as well. Religion has a lot to do to contributing towards removing it those two working days from the week. So I think we're looking at a lot of stuff because of the impact of COVID. You know, a lot of people experienced kind of a near death experience, right? So we kind of realigned what our expectations were for work and for family. You know, we saw divorce rates skyrocket. We saw people opt out of work. People were retiring earlier when they had longer plans. And then you see workforce, especially in like hospitality, just decide to opt out of work altogether. So, you know, I've just come back from Europe. There's still restaurants not being able to have as many people in them as they'd like because they can't get the workforce to service that. So by just adding more hours to the working day or working week, you're not going to see those performance gains and those profitability gains that you might expect by just having people work longer. It doesn't work like that. It's not longer hours equals better performance. It's actually shorter hours equals better performance, productivity and profitability for organizations.
What is the answer though? Because, you know, countries have a limited workforce, or to a certain extent, immigration, obviously, and companies have limited budgets. They can't give everything what they want, everybody what they want all of the time. So where's the sweet spot?
I think it's looking at the data. It's not taking a knee-jerk reaction and thinking that, you know, A equals B in every instance. It's not as superficial as that. You've got to scratch the surface, look at the data, look at some of the research that's coming out of the UAE. You know, if we look at the engagement rates across the UAE since we implemented the 4.5-day work week, 4-day work week in Sharjah, We've nearly doubled our engagement rates in this region. We're now comparable to Canada and America, which has the highest engagements in the world. And then you've got to look at traffic incidents. They've reduced by 40% as well. So Greece are quite likely to see a less engaged workforce and probably more traffic incidents as well by elongating the working week.
Where do you think the working week debate is going? And again, I realise that if we're talking about, you know, a lot of sort of blue collar workers, we're not talking about a standard 5-day work week as we are we? But if we look at the white collar professions at the moment, will we reach a point, I don't know, your kids maybe, your kids' kids, where the idea of having a set work week is just like us explaining that once upon the time our telephones were fixed to the wall and you could only move, you know, 70 centimetres in any direction while they look at you in bafflement? Or is there a blip, and with the memories of COVID fading and again another generation, will we go back?
I think the more data we can garner from employees and around their performance, the better insights we'll have to decide on what that working week looked like and how many hours in a day one works. So if you look at the data currently, we on average work about 2.5 hours of productive work in a given day. The rest of that time is kind of, you know, the cannon fodder of meetings. And that was the big savior of the 4-day work week. We actually reduced the length of meetings. Instead of an hour, it's now 30 minutes. We're like, you know, reducing the elements that aren't so essential for business performance. So it's looking at data, it's garnering those insights and figuring out what is the best for the employee and the organization, both individually and at a larger level.
How does this factor then into compensation and benefits? Does this become another piece in the puzzle?
Absolutely. It's whether you want to be an attractive organization or not. You know, we're currently in an employer market, right? So they get the say of who they want to hire and when. There was a couple of years ago where it was an employee market and employees were not just, you know, working for one company, they're working for multiple and then deciding who those organizations were themselves. So I think these conversations are timely because it is an employer market, but once it switches back to an employee market again, you're going to start to see some of those peripheral benefits starting to ramp up and ways to entice employees into those businesses because they want to get the best talent, right? Nobody wants mediocrity in their business. They want the top talent. And in order to get that, you have to incentivize them to come to your business.
How much is this, though, a reality for white-collar employees here in the UAE? I mean, EAND made headlines a couple of weeks ago because it was implementing a four-day working week for certain departments. Now, the reason it made headlines is because that is still the exception. I mean, you are a consultant in the private or the semi-private sector. How many companies are you actually seeing put this into play?
Well, white collar covers public as well. I have a meeting in Abu Dhabi after this with the public sector there at 4.5 day working week. I think it's quite ironic with the Greek statement, actually, is that it's just for the private sector that's doing the 6 day work week. You're not seeing the politicians opting to do 6 days, are you? It's just supposed to drive more revenue and business to the country that is actually bleeding talent. They're losing a lot of their young talent to go overseas where they can potentially earn more money. And that's what they're trying to do, is stimulate the economy. But of course, they're going to lose more of their younger talent, who, of course, might be looking at more favorable regions that pay better, such as the UAE and, of course, Dubai. Come to Dubai.
Well, we are also hearing in, though, from a lot of people on the sales front, retail front, talking about the 6 day week as a norm.
Yeah.
Oliver, thank you so much for your time this morning. Oliver Baxter, founder and owner of Workplace Maven. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right. And looking around some of the big infrastructure news of the last couple of the days, and that's Dubai planning to nearly double the number of metro stations that we have in the Emirate. They're looking at 140 odd by 2040. We've been thinking, okay, what does it mean for the real estate industry? Very pleased to be joined by Andrew Elliott. He's the director of the commercial agency at Chesterton's. Morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Brandy.
Let's have a look. Let's deal separately with both residential and commercial. But if we start with residential, what do we know about what a public transport link can mean for how much your house is worth?
Typically, anywhere that new metro lines / train lines that run through any established cities, typically prices within the immediate vicinity of the metro station or train station will increase probably between 5 and 20%. We've looked at a few cities across the world where new lines have been put in place. Different cities, different results. But you tend to find that the most increase in property prices will be the first sort of 500 metres of the station, and then as it goes out from there, obviously the prices decrease.
Given our weather, does immediate vicinity change here in Dubai?
I think there has been a demand over when the previous metro was handed over. People want to be as close to the metro, especially if they are using it, if it's a workplace. Companies have, for the last sort of 10, 12 years, had one of the criteria of they want to be close to the metro station as possible.
Right, so impacting commercial values and rents
definitely
as well.
Definitely attracted that. It's also helped the retail. So retail around metro stations has done fantastically well. Obviously, when you've got a footfall that's walking out of a metro station straight past your front door, it does achieve higher rents. Office space in those areas have also achieved higher rents.
So let's look at some of the knock-on effects in terms of what it means, firstly, for the residential. Does it not also make a lot more places livable?
It does, and I think that's one thing that's going to happen with the new metro lines as we sort of move more into the Dubai land state, where it will make it a lot more commutable, because at the moment, most of our commercial space is still on Sheikh Zayed Road. And I think once we start having lines that run sort of into your communities like Damak Hills, Arabian Ranches 2, I think that will also encourage more people to move away from the city centre. Obviously, that becomes villa communities. I also think at some stage, those metro stations will start to attract commercial properties again, because at the moment, most of our commercial is Sheikh Zayed Road. And I think once we start having lines further into the communities, it will bring up new communities of commercial space.
How big could that get, though? Because most places, even with strong public transport, will still have a CBD.
I think that will always, you'll never get away from that. I mean, DIFC will probably always be there. Downtown will always be there, and that will attract certain type of companies. But I think there's also other companies that don't necessarily need to be in the CBD, and they will be happy to move away from that. Their staff don't need to fight the traffic every morning to get into the offices. And I think that will encourage companies to look at spaces outside the city, and obviously rents will be lower.
So it's not just that where a metro station is will have an effect on rents and values, but whether or not a development even gets built?
I think the way Dubai works, you will typically be building developments knowing that there is a new metro station coming up. I think that will also encourage, and I'd like to think that they put extra parking around these metro stations to make it more of a commutable into the city centre. And that will obviously encourage people to look at communities where they can maybe walk to the metro station, or a partner can drop them at the metro station and they can go into work.
What does it mean for the land banks then around this?
Land will probably start to get rezoned as soon as new metro stations get announced. That will obviously increase the value of that land. And then you're in the position that the land will probably be sold off, which will obviously encourage developers to start developing there. So definitely as soon as metro lines are announced, you start to see land being rezoned.
Right. So where the metro stations pop up, and I've looked at a couple of maps this morning, there's a lot of metro activity, as you say, coming inland to the east and a lot of it going to the south as well. Is it going to change where projects will be built?
I think it will definitely open up new areas. I think it will also open up opportunities for new developers to start new communities. And I think that will then obviously start to push people maybe not so much living along the coastline, but moving more inland.
Okay, so if you think that some areas more inland could become more commercially attractive, where could we also see things becoming more residentially friendly?
I think if you look at Dubai land and that side of town, that is where the majority of the land is sitting at the moment. I don't think there's too much land with inside what I call the inner city level, so keeping inside of El Kail Road. There's not a lot of land left there to be developed. So I sort of feel we have to move outside the city limits. The metro is going to open that up for a lot of people, and that will obviously encourage communities to start to set up, new districts to set up further away from sort of Sheikh Zayed Road, El Kail Road.
Will it actually change our driving habits though? Car ownership?
It might do. And I think any normal city that has new metro lines or train station lines, people start thinking, well, I don't need a second car. I think in Dubai, we've sort of quite happy to use two cars or three cars. I think as communities start to have metro stations, maybe they don't need two cars anymore. Maybe the husband will be commuting to work on the train, or the wife commutes to work on the train, and the family uses the car during the day.
We have to look at the catchment area, though, of those metro stations, and again, the weather. Is it a shorter or a smaller circle, if you like? I mean, I've just come back from Singapore, where you have the big networks underground. Yep. That mean that each station is serving a much larger area, because you've got the retail components. Yep. and the F&B components underground, almost like a spider's web, and then you pop out in different parts of the city. Other places might be a bit more walkable for each metro station. I mean, is there a metric of how far each one can serve?
I think, and this is where I was saying just now about the fact that parking will need to be provided at these metro stations to attract people within communities that can maybe drive, park at a metro station, leave their car for the day, or have a partner drop them at a metro station and they can commute. So the big thing here, I think, is all of these metro stations being built in communities will need to have parking, because if you look at Arabian Ranches 2, to get from the centre of the community to the metro station could be 3 or 4 kilometres. You can't really walk that most of the time of the year in Dubai. And I think that will need some sort of transport within the communities to get you to metro stations, whether that be buses, whether that be parking at the metro stations. That will need to be decided.
It still makes us quite car dependent, though, doesn't it?
I think yes and no. I think if there was more metros running into these communities at the moment, I think you'll be in a position that a lot of the service providers maybe don't need cars to get out there anymore. There's a lot of obviously minibuses that carry staff that work in people's villas, people that work in the malls or the sort of community malls. They are all using minibuses at the moment. And as soon as the metro lines come on, a lot of those people will be able to get onto the metros. I think for families, maybe one car is only needed for the school runs. They can drop the husband at the metro in the morning. He can get the kids can go to school, or wife. I did say partners most of the time. Can then drop off one of them at the metro station, take the kids to school, keep the car at home for the rest of the day.
What does it, 30 seconds left with you, what does it mean for then what we choose to spend our money on when it comes to property investment?
I think anybody looking at capital growth will always look at train and commuter, whichever city you are in the world. Properties around metro stations, train stations will always grow quicker than anywhere else. You will develop a commuter belt. That commuter belt will then obviously rely on the metro. I think if people do have the mindset of I'm happy to use the metro, they will look for properties as close to the metro stations as possible.
Andrew Elliott, director of the commercial agency at Chesterton's, talking to us about what more metro stations could mean, not just for property values and rents, but where properties are built in the first place. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.